Talk Shoes. Recorded live.
We're going to start off with talking about the different roles of ministers and how they're described. And everyone should be a minister of God. Everyone should be an altar of clay, an Adama altar, which is serving God in one way or another. But we also have these altars of stone, which are individuals who somehow or other are being ministers of God's kingdom. And since Christ came to serve, they come to serve because they're representatives of Christ. And we have a couple different designations. One is commissioned, one is licensed, and one is ordained ministers. In fact, an ordained minister can also be a commissioned and licensed minister as well. Real quick, commissioned minister is someone on a mission. He's been given a mission by another minister to go and do something, preach the gospel, be a missionary. So he is what we call a commissioned minister, or you could call him a missionary. But when we use the term missionary, everybody figures you're in Africa somewhere preaching to heathens. But it's really just someone who's on a mission who doesn't have a particular congregation of his own that he is serving. Now, the term licensed minister is very controversial because we think that somehow or other the church is giving license to someone to be a minister, and that would be completely wrong. Christ is the one who calls the minister to minister, but the idea of license is that the minister is recognized by people to be their minister. So they're giving him license to say that he is their minister. And they're the ones who issue the license, the permission to be their minister at, you know, Cottonwood or wherever. And they're the ones who issue the license. And give you another example of that, we have a marriage license that we create in our documentation. And the one who gives the license for an individual to get married is the father and the mother. The father and the mother will sign in a spot where they're giving permission for their child to get married. And, of course, if they don't have a father and mother, if their parents have already died, we recommend that they get someone else in their family to recognize, because by marrying, you're bringing this other person into your family. And so, therefore, you should have someone in your family who recognizes. So it's that family member or the parent who actually gives the license, not the church. The church doesn't issue the license. And, of course, that's exactly what the world does. If you get a marriage license from the state is acting as the father. They're giving you permission to marry. And, of course, that falls under parents patria statutes. We should realize that, and we talk about that in holy matrimony versus marriage. So, anyway, now an ordained minister is someone who is ordained of God. He has met all the qualifications required by Christ. He has taken all his property and sold it or the funds for it and given it to the poor or gave it to the church for the purposes of the poor. And, of course, the poor is not people who are without money. It's those people who need the help of those altars of stone in order to be a part of the kingdom of God. If we were all the way we should be, we would only need altars of clay, and we'd all be doing our job. But we need help with our unbelief, and that's why God allows us to have altars of stone. In other words, individuals. Now, how those stones fit together, that will be up to them. We can't chisel them. We can't regulate them. We can't rule over them. And this brings in an important concept. When you have a ministry, a congregation of record, that congregation of record is represented by one man, never a board. It's never, and this is a big problem in churches, it's represented by that one man, and when you give to that one man, you give to him entirely. And he is the one that has the choice of how to handle that contribution. Now, if he is a licensed or a commissioned minister, not ordained minister, he may not be able to take a portion of that for his own personal use without paying taxes on it, depending on any contracts he may have. But if he is a minister who is gathered together in an order with other ministers, all those funds, he would have access to decide how they were to be used accordingly. So anyway, I don't know if that brings up any other questions. One of the things that we need to always be realizing is that the church is empowering individuals. It's not empowering boards or corporations. So everything that we create, every institution, every trust that we create, which is a topic that we'll be discussing at another time, is empowering somebody to make choices. And hopefully those choices would be in accordance with Christ. And we empower somebody else to kind of oversee that, to see that they are doing that. And the overseers are a part of that recognition process. So that if we're recognizing that so-and-so has the right to make decisions in this congregation of record as to how the funds are distributed, then that recognition continues. And the reason it's a church of record is because the overseer has to continue bearing witness that that individual is making those decisions. If we don't have an overseer, the state will want to come in and claim to be that overseer. So you'll have to have ministers that are willing to appear in court, appear before the rulers of the world and say, you know, thou sayest it, we are separate. But we also have to really be separate. As we see going on in our modern times, they're separating us out on a pretty regular basis now. The original topic was, banking, and I got eventually into credit unions, and Kendall Anderson has shown an interest in credit unions recently on his own. He didn't realize they had written so much on the subject. It would be great as the network grows if we couldn't get somebody interested in forming a credit union, a His Church credit union. That could be extremely useful in the days to come. Again, I'm digging potatoes if you hear me grunting and groaning occasionally.
I thought you did that last week.
I got one more row. I gave away a couple hundred pounds the day before yesterday. But I don't want to leave them in the ground here, and I've already dug probably 150 pounds just sitting here. So.
Yeah, we went out in the fields and gleaned about 500 pounds a week ago.
Yeah, we've already got 500 pounds stored away in the root cellar, but we don't usually put up much more than that for our own use. But there's at least a couple hundred pounds left in this row that I haven't got to yet.
So if we come for dinner, then we get homemade French fries. Is that it?
Well, we could arrange that. Come out and help me dig some of these potatoes. I wanted to have a talk about creating any institution that we create that becomes auxiliaries of the church. We still fall under the non-filing requirements. And I sent off something this morning to the contact minister showing them that even the statutes of the states, and I believe this is the result of the federal influence, is that, you know, they categorize who doesn't have to register with the state, with the attorney general, et cetera. You know, they're talking, of course, the federal government doesn't, and the institutions of the federal government, and religious organizations that are institutions of the church, and then, of course, cemeteries.
Hey, Gregory, this is Bobby Mohan with Council Bluffs, and you had mentioned a cemetery. Couldn't a congregation of record have a cemetery?
Congregation of record, I recommend that they do have a cemetery. It's just that in some states they're requiring that you register that cemetery with the state now, unless it was grandfathered in. So it would be nice if you had property that already had a grandfathered in cemetery. Well, as a matter of fact, I've seen where churches had cemeteries in the past. The church land has been abandoned. It wasn't a part of a big church. You know, a big institutional church, and eventually all the people moved away, and there was still church property there. It was off the tax rolls, and nobody was doing anything with it. The only thing that was there, the building had fallen down, the only thing that was there was the cemetery. There isn't any reason in the world that you couldn't just move on to that property.
Right.
Get the names off the cemetery stone. Write everybody's relatives, you know, try to find some of their relatives, write them and ask them if they want to be a part of your church.
Right.
You get letters back or no letters back. You just basically set up the church there.
You just stand on the land there, right?
you could stand on the land, but you better be a church. And
right.
And I can only recommend you be a church established by Christ, and that's, of course, what we teach is what that looks
right.
like, it should look like.
Right.
There, actually, those of you who were here at the retreat and went up to the sunrise service, up there on that hill we have a cemetery location where we have at least one person's ashes buried, and that's on that property. So, I think that's very important because... simply because I see it showing up in the Bible is that the only land that Abraham owned was a cemetery plot.
Now, Greg, once a church has taken property off the tax rolls, there is no more registration process. Is that correct?
I'm not sure. I haven't researched that in relationship to burying bodies. The burying body thing, they can claim the fact that you're burying organic material that you could be affecting water, et cetera, and so they can have some excuse to come in and want to know what you're doing. But obviously, if it's already a cemetery, that's already been accepted and grandfathered in.
It'd be interesting if they said you're not allowed to bury anybody with amalgam fillings.
Well, that's the whole thing with having to embalm people. You don't want to be doing that.
No,
that sounds so Egyptian anyway.
That's just a money maker.
Yeah, it sounds more
macabre.
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, come on, that's just kind of a bizarre thing. And what's the point? I mean, what is the whole theory behind it? Oh, gee, we're going to preserve this body? Why? Why?
I want a new one.
Yeah. What's the point?
It's probably undoubted that some people have been killed on the embalming table.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Because they've had a number of people wake up on the embalming table, we can probably safely assume that some of them didn't wake up.
Yeah, didn't wake up in time.
One of the things that we don't see in the early New Testament, when they talk about believers and unbelievers
right.
and the church and owning all things in common, there was clearly Christ appointing a kingdom to his little flock.
Mm-hmm.
These were the apostles, the men that I just had this discussion with Kendall about. People want to say there are no more apostles, and the word apostolos just had
that's
this discussion.
That's all it means.
Yeah, apostolos is the word for ambassador.
Yes.
And that ambassador is representing who? He's representing the king.
King, yes.
And so the fact is that group that's representing the king, which is the called out, the church,
mm-hmm.
that's the ministers who own all things in common, who don't have any personal estate, the ordained ministers. And they are there as literally a corporate body of Christ, but the congregation of record is not a corporate body. The people that are in the congregation of record can have all kinds of different statuses. And they may be a slave in Egypt. They may be a free man in Cilicia. They may be... Aquirus in Rome, these are all different statuses, but the congregation is bound only by faith, hope, and charity,
right.
and those things aren't taxed yet, so those are outside of the jurisdiction of the government. So when they talk about believers and unbelievers in the New Testament, they're not talking about the general congregation, they're talking about the minister's status. A believer and unbeliever. A believer was someone who, believed enough to give up everything he had, to own all things in common, to be this church, these ministers of Christ, to go out and serve the congregations who are bound by faith, hope, and charity, who are not corporations, and try and return every man to his family and to his possession. So now the question is, if a minister is a believer and he's called out, can he be married to a woman who's still in the system?
Right.
If she agrees to that, but I would actually document that. If you're just a member of the congregation, then there's no problem. But you need to document that.
Right. Now, now, by associating yourself with a congregation of record, are you rebutting certain presumptions?
No. That's the thing. And I know that's been floating around. If your status depends upon your membership in a congregation, then you're subject to that congregation. That congregation is actually becoming an unincorporated association.
Gotcha. Okay.
You don't want that. The congregation is something bound by faith, open charity, and love.
Right.
It's an institution. If it's overseen by the church, that is not registered with the state, and so whatever you give to that institution can't be touched by the state. It's separate, and that church can start to provide a social welfare that is separate from the world. But your status is dependent upon what you do and how you relate to the
right.
world, not upon the congregation. If it did, then someone in that congregation could jeopardize your status by what he does, and you don't want that.
I shouldn't have made it sound just as far as joining the congregation of record, but going through that process would show that you are entering into a kingdom and leaving one kingdom for another kingdom.
Well, it starts setting a record that you're going in a particular direction, but your path and how those steps you take in that direction can't be tied to the congregation,
right, at all.
Or someone else's, who's a member of that congregation, could put you in jeopardy, which is
right.
why we want. I just talked to Herbert Titus this week, and he started slipping back into this idea of the church being an unincorporated association, and I had trouble with that before. You do not want to be an unincorporated association, because then anything that one of the members does can affect the status of all the others. The church is an institution, a religious institution, to help you survive as a free soul under God. It is not the source of your freedom.
Freedom, right.
Your freedom is dependent upon what you do. Now, if you marry and have relations, it's just like if you go get married to someone who is the daughter of a mafioso, that mafioso may hold you to account, by the terms of, you're married to their daughter.
Right.
And so if they're in the system and you're not, your status put it this way, your responsibilities may be affected by that union.
They would certainly impress that upon you.
Yeah, and they could push that issue.
That's what I'm wondering here, because here it is. My wife and I have come into this new journey and are wanting to be a part of this, but at the same time, we want to make sure that each other is protected from any type of restriction that the state might try to hinder on the other, even though they're not a citizen.
Right. And see, what you want to do is have agreements, literally prenuptial agreements that recognize these separate statuses and these separate positions.
Because when my wife and I just came to this community, Gregory, we had already had a contract with the state, not understanding what that contract was when we entered in to our marriage.
Uh-huh.
Obviously the contract is no time limit other than death or divorce. And so, I don't like the idea that that the state will still have some sort of authority from that union prior to me coming into a congregation of record and changing status.
Right, and I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about when I say contract. And there was a guy who was married, who they were having trouble, and they were thinking about divorce.
Uh-huh.
And they went to the church, and it was an unregistered church, a guy I known for a long time. And he says, okay, well, I'll arbitrate this, but before I do, you guys sign a contract that you accept arbitration, it's not binding arbitration, but even unbinding arbitration, you accept
right.
arbitration with the church before you have any take this matter to state.
Right, to the unrighteous courts, right.
And in the course of events, the guy eventually got impatient, filed for divorce, and the minister just simply brought in that contract, and the judge immediately dismissed the case.
Okay.
Because they hadn't gone through church arbitration. Well, that's just in one example, but you can do that in many ways. The power of contract is what has bound everybody in.
Right.
And by the same token, work both ways.
That's good to know. Because, I mean, you know, we were thinking, well, now what do we, should we get divorced? You know, should, you know, there was just a number of scenarios that we were actually trying to parlay to figure out, well, I don't want to go back into those courts again. You know what I mean? I mean, so it's just one of those things that, you know, you don't really consider until you start pursuing something like this, how it's going to affect each other.
You know, these things don't bury easy. They can come back and haunt you for a long time. And it's a struggle, and there's no, you know, single thing that cure all.
Right.
But the fact is the problems that we're going to be facing in the future here, I mean, this economy slipping away as it is, we've got a number of things coming out this month that could change all kinds of situations. We're on the verge of food shortages, everything else. People need to come together in these congregations just to survive.
Right.
And the other peripheral issues of jurisdiction and stuff,
those will be secondary.
They will seem trivial and secondary when we're dealing with the other more immediate issues.
Right.
But not that they're not important, but anyway, I do want to impress upon people the importance of the fact that your status is not, you don't enter in a congregation of record and then you're in the kingdom
right.
by any way. You know, one of the things that, when I point out in the book, booklet, Call No Man on Earth Father, Call No Man Father Upon the Earth, I guess is what it is. The Romans understood this idea of making the state your father. They understood it really well, and they spoke about it openly without question. Most Americans have no idea
not a clue.
Of what that is all about. But the reality was they said this was such an important change in the status of an individual, there had to be three parts to it. And the first part was birth registration. The second part was accepting benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And the third part was making a sacrifice on the altar, which was the equivalent to a 1040. Once we understand that those three elements are required before the state can become your father, we see how they pay attention to these details. So by the same token, if you want to separate yourself and say that God is your father, you need to have a way of identifying your members through a chain of authentication. We do it with baptism, which is the birth again.
Right.
And you can do that even with children to set that precedent that these children belong to this jurisdiction and not that jurisdiction. You need to approach it from that point of view of jurisdiction, which is what I write about in Thy Kingdom Come and several other places. And then we also have to supply benefits.
Right.
These congregations should be contributing to one another and providing for one another. One of the problems we had with some of the congregations, they said, well, we get together, but nobody has any needs because they're all a bunch of self-reliant people.
We're guilty of that sometimes as well. I mean,
but what you do have a need for is more people.
Right.
We need more monkeys, and we need to put an effort and even maybe funds or time or energy into finding more people. And that's why I write these books and make these radio shows and willing to go on a radio show any time or day or night. I give up paying jobs to go on these radio shows so that I can find more people who will join the network.
Right.
You know, we were talking this morning with Rick, and people are still too spread out. We need to connect the dots. That means that I need to find more people in every area that they're closer so that these congregations can actually meet and be there for each other. And you can't do that when half your congregation is 150 miles away.
This is a suggestion for the network. If you don't mind, I can interject some. When Scott and I, over here at Council Bluffs, we've met with people that have been traveling through, you know, that way there they get to put a face with the name, and we just actually just stay in contact with, you know, as well as on the board, you know, for your group, you know, and that way there you get to meet and greet those in the network, and we're trying to establish some type of thing, a meeting with the people from Colorado, with Dan and Carol, and maybe like a halfway type of a thing. We don't know exactly how that's going to go, but that's all we can do at this present time. I mean, as you say, we are spread out, but at the same time, that doesn't limit us as well. You know, it's just a matter of what it means to you, you know. And obviously with our group, we yearn for that, and we strive for that, and so that's why we're a connected group.
Yeah, that's the same out here. When the people came out here, everybody was very pleased with the meeting. I think that the caliber of people we had showed up because of the fact that these people, so many of them were contact ministers who have actually taken the time to make not only their own congregation stronger, but to keep them in contact with the others. I mean, this idea of a national and international network is absolutely essential. We need more foreign addresses of contact and you know, congregations of record, and we need to have those connected. But, you know, right now I'm the only one writing. I'm the only one making radio shows and recordings. We've had a few guys do others. I am too important to this network. We need to have other people that are forming their own momentum on the ground in their own local groups and then connect those groups. And we've seen that before where people just wanted to get their own group going and everybody else became superfluous. And that's just not kingdom thinking.
No, it's not.
And it's not the way we define a contact minister. A contact minister is interested in connecting his group with other groups as he is in forming his own group. And that's been a real problem with the church. It's why the Roman church was able to destroy freedom in Europe and just march into one valley after another and conquer it, because it could put a large army into the field, and valleys did not come and protect other valleys. They didn't come and protect the freedom of the guy in the next valley. And that one item alone is what led to the conquest of the kingdom of God by the apostate church.
Wouldn't you classify this as the Dark Ages or comparable?
Say again?
I said, wouldn't you consider this time as close to the Dark Ages as the time itself? I mean, as comparable.
Right. I wrote about the Dark Ages in Thy Kingdom Come, and the fact is the Dark Ages weren't all that dark. There were people who were, there was a great deal of education, there was a huge amount of freedom, there were people who were living without war. It was Dark Ages for people who wanted to be king, but it wasn't Dark Ages for the free man living on his own land and be simple. Today is the Dark Age, and the biggest mission field for Christianity is America, because there's hardly an American who understands Christianity.
Yeah.
They don't understand the kingdom. They're all into churchanity.
Yeah.